And you're listening to The Rundown, a news and information show where we look at emerging stories, current events, politics, and ideas. Here on the program, you can hear conversations with local newsmakers, trailblazers, cultural entrepreneurs, and more. Today, we begin with a look at the local headlines. A fire in southeastern Utah that was being called the largest in a three-state radius has been 100% contained. The Black Mountain Fire near the small town of Minersville in Beaver County was started by lightning last week and burned more than 4,500 acres before it was contained on Saturday. Nick Howell, a fire information officer with the Bureau of Land Management, says that firefighters are still on site and that their aim is to entirely extinguish any remnants of the fire before the end of the day tomorrow.
We still have a number of crews on scene right now. They are securing the remaining hotspots, and they hope to have the fire completely controlled by probably tomorrow afternoon if the weather conditions cooperate today.
Two firefighters were hospitalized with heat exhaustion and dehydration while battling the blaze. But Howell says they are expected to make a full recovery.
The day it happened, there were some really hot and dry conditions. It was a crew from out of the area that maybe was not used to the heat that we had here at this point in time. And they were working the fire line and simply just overheated. It was a case of heat exhaustion and dehydration. And they are both on their way to making a full recovery.
Howell went on to say that while the Black Mountain Fire has been contained, persistent hot and dry conditions and ongoing thunderstorms mean that firefighters will continue to be busy.
Yesterday, as a matter of fact, we had 25 new fires that were all lightning caused, and we've had multiple resources dealing with those, even as we speak today.
And moving on to political news, a new database aims to make it easier for you to find out who is donating to candidates and elected officials. KCPW's Kim Shusky looks into a searchable website unveiled today by a government watchdog organization.
Looking up which companies or individuals have donated to your local senator is not an easy task. Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell's office keeps electronic versions of all of these campaign finance records, but they are broken up into multiple disclosure periods that happen within a campaign. Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of Alliance for a Better Utah, says it's like looking through a needle in multiple haystacks.
We know that we have very little campaign finance restrictions, so people can pretty much donate just about whatever they want. And we just felt this was a tool that would allow people to actually dig a little deeper. This way they can very easily find out just exactly who donated to their representative.
Martindale says after years of being frustrated by the way the data was presented, they decided there had to be a better way. She says everything came to a head for them when they were trying to look through financial disclosure information for Attorney General John Swallow.
On the Lieutenant Governor's site, you have to find your elected official, you have to find which filing you want to see, you have to go into that particular filing and either download it or look at it, and then you have to back out, and as soon as you back out, it takes you all the way to the beginning again. So then you have to go through and you have to find your elected official again, find his next filing of that same year. Our system is very different. It dumps everything.
For Swallow, there are 489 total transactions that are split into five filed reports on the Lieutenant Governor's office site for the 2012 campaign. So to do a search, you would have to know which donating entity you are looking for and during which disclosure statement the donation was made. Otherwise, you would have to sort all five documents by hand. The new website, found at followthemoney.abueducation.org, spits out all of the records in alphabetical order.
So, for example, my representative happens to be Brian King. If I were to type in Brian King, it would give me every donation ever made to Brian King, period. It would tell me when all those donations were made, but it would give me one long record that would show it all.
The full records can be downloaded onto a computer and uploaded to a spreadsheet software program such as Microsoft Excel. Then that data can be easily searched in whatever way you might want. Martindale says in the future, the new website will be updated within 24 hours after the disclosures are first published on the Lieutenant Governor's site. For KCPW, I'm Kim Shusky.
You're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. Now on the program, we turn to our discussion with Dr. Jeffrey Tabin of the University of Utah's Moran Eye Center. Dr. Tabin and a Nepalese doctor are the subject of a new book called Second Sons, about their innovative work removing cataracts in the developing world. Dr. Jeff Tabin, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the book Second Sons, it's by bestselling author David Oliver Rellen, came out on June 18th. And the book is a profile of the work you and Dr. Sanduk Ruit, am Am I saying that
right? Yeah, saying perfectly.
Okay. It's the work that you guys do to cure blindness in Nepal. Tell us a little bit about the Himalayan Cataract Project and your work in Nepal.
Well, it's actually a wonderful book. Really, it's about my friendship and kind of the odd friendship of myself with Sandek Rui. And he makes us out to be, I guess maybe we are, two pretty eccentric characters and changing eye care in one of the poorest places on the planet. And just as a bit of background, 90% of the blindness in our world is in the poorest countries of the world, in the developing world. And of that, 85% could be completely treated or could have easily been prevented. And half of the blindness is from completely treatable cataracts. Oh. And after college, I was given a scholarship to go to Oxford University in England for 2 years. I'd already been accepted to medical school, and I was able to kind of step back for 2 years, and I studied philosophy at Oxford, but really looked at comparative healthcare systems and the economics of healthcare delivery around the world. And I matriculated at Harvard Medical School, already knowing I wanted to do something in international health, international eye care, just in international health. I had no idea about the eye care. And I was also a very keen rock climber when I was in high school, and fanatical climber in college, and climbing kind of already brought me to the developing world and to Nepal. And so after I finished my medical school, I was trying to figure out how to do something to improve the healthcare system in Nepal. I'd already developed a really great love for the people and the culture, and it was also a convenient place for me to go and continue my mountaineering.
Had you at this time climbed the Seven Summits?
I hadn't at that time. I had climbed actually, I was with an American team. The book kind of goes into my kind of a little bit of crazy climbing history, but I had already been with a team that made the first ascent of the east face of Mount Everest, and I'd already summited Everest. I actually went to the summit of Everest in 1988 with the first American woman to climb Mount Everest. We had two women, and I was the token boy. And this was in the years before the big expeditions and so many people coming to the mountain.
It became sort of
a
tourist.
But I also was doing a lot of climbing, a lot of first ascents of smaller peaks and sort of hard technical ascents of sort of 6,000-meter peaks in Nepal. But I was over trying to sort of struggling how to get involved and what to do with eye care, with health care. And I saw that most of the problems were really public health issues, that there were things that an individual doctor couldn't have much impact on, problems related to clean water, poor nutrition, lack of vaccinations, lack of general basic care. And I saw children dying of things that were so easy to deal with in the developed world that I could do nothing about.
Wow.
And the one amazing miracle I saw was cataract surgery. And it just absolutely blew my mind. You know, here in America, we have one ophthalmologist for every 18,000 people. And when people have a little trouble seeing at night and their vision's blurred, I work here at the University of Utah's Moran Eye Center. They come to the Moran Eye Center with a little bit of blurred vision, and we do perfect cataract surgery. Yep. And I do very nice cataract surgery, but if I'm not here to do cataract surgery, my partner Alan Crandall does just as great surgery, as does Mark Mifflin, as does Nick Mamelis, as does Randy Olson. We've got lots of people who do great cataract surgery. Well, in Nepal, this was back in 1989, there was not a single doctor from Nepal for 24 million people doing cataract surgery with lens implants.
So one for every 18,000 here in the U.S. and zero for 24 million.
Right. And the costs were really prohibitive. I watched a Dutch team come in, and in the village where I was working, it was just accepted that you get old, your hair turns white, your eye turns white, and then you die. And people would just kind of shrivel up, become depressed, wait to die. And the mortality, once you go blind in the developing world, is one-third, or the life expectancy is one-third that of age and health-matched peers. Mm. And a Nepali expression for a blind person is a mouth with no hands. And when you're in a subsistence agrarian economy, having a blind person is just an overwhelming burden. And I watched a Dutch team come and do cataract surgery, and it was just the most amazing thing. People went from being totally blind to seeing perfectly.
Right.
And from being completely shriveled up, depressed, to just blossoming back into life.
What a transformation.
And I went, wow, this is something I can do. At that time, there was an estimated backlog of over 200,000 completely blind. When I say blind, it's not, you know, in America we give benefits when you can see two lines down on the eye chart, you're legally blind. These are people who can't do the tasks of daily living, can't go to the toilet by themselves, can't feed themselves, they can't find anything. They're, you know, they can't see the shadow of a hand move in front of their face. And so not only are they out of the workforce, but it often takes a second person out of the workforce or a child out of school to care for the blind person. Mm-hmm. And my focus already was towards creating systems and establishing the infrastructure. And I thought, wow, this is something I could do. And I got all excited. I came back to the States and started my ophthalmology residency. Now, what I didn't know is that there was Sandok Ruid in this world, who really is the most amazing man. And I think of anyone on our planet, I don't think there's done anyone I know of who has done more to individually alleviate suffering on our planet than my partner, Sandok Ruid.
So when did you meet Sandok Ruid, and tell us about him?
He was born in a small hill village, 4 days' walk from the nearest road, with no electricity, no running water, and no schools. And you know, I travel a lot now in the developing world. I wonder what would have happened to me had I been born in a circumstance like him. Yeah. And somehow he was so brilliant. At age 8, some of the Buddhist monks said, this boy is so brilliant, he needs to go to school. His father walked him for 12 days to Darjeeling, India, and then left him. And he didn't see another family member for 2 years.
Wow.
And he did so well in his studies, he won a full scholarship to one of the very best medical schools in India. He then scored number one on the Indian medical exams and was given a full scholarship to come and train as an ophthalmologist at the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in Delhi, which is the Indian equivalent of Harvard Medical School. And he came to Nepal, and his talents were noticed actually by the same Dutch team that I had watched. And what I didn't know when I was doing my research and finding there was no one doing cataract surgery in Nepal was that Dr. Rui was already back in the Netherlands retraining as a microsurgeon in the Netherlands. And after that, he went to Australia and lived for 2 years in Australia with a legendary curmudgeon of ophthalmology named Fred Hollows, and retrained again and tried to figure out a way to bring absolute state-of-the-art care at a very low cost. He had also, there's another fantastic partner organization of ours called the Aravind Eye Hospital Systems out of Tamil Nadu, India. And he'd also done a fellowship in Tamil Nadu, seeing the very best of high-volume surgery. So when I came back to do my residency, we kind of passed in the night. Dr. Rui came back to Nepal and became the first doctor in Nepal to use lens implants and do modern microsurgery for cataracts. And he already created this wonderful concept that people who were paying for surgery could subsidize the poor. And prior to Dr. Rui, anyone with any means at all in Nepal would travel to Delhi to have their cataract surgery. If they had more money, they'd go to Europe or America. And if you think of how much it costs to fly from Kathmandu to Los Angeles, stay in a hotel, pay our medical system's full cost, people were very happy to pay. And so he took some of the insights that had been created down at the Aravind Eye Hospital System for very high volume surgery, and said, we're going to give the same quality lens implant to everybody, whether they can pay or not, but the paying patients will subsidize the poor.
And where was the funding for that coming from?
The initial funding came from Australian charities. Fred Hollows, unfortunately, died of cancer, and he used his last energies and some of his celebrity in Australia to raise money for a lens implant factory to manufacture the lens implants we use, which cost hundreds of dollars in the States, for $5 a lens in Nepal, and really changed the system. And Nepal charities, and also a few wealthy Nepalis and a Buddhist, the Jangmen Kongtrul Rinpoche Trust, helped start his initial surgery center. And I was just kind of in the right place at the right time. I did my fellowship under Hugh Taylor, who is the world's expert on several infectious causes of blindness, river blindness in Africa, also trachoma. And I did a corneal transplant and advanced cataract surgery fellowship there. And Professor Taylor sent me over to work with Dr. Ruit. Wow. And I came over thinking I was going to teach something. I had come I had all the fanciest, highest pedigree, most prestigious training programs in the West. And I came to Nepal and I was absolutely blown away. And Dr. Ruit had already developed this incredible system of delivery and very high volume surgery in remote areas, a system of training mid-level health workers to do a lot of the screening, going to where the blind patients are. It's all in the book.
It's in the book. But
anyways, I came over and the first cataract program, they had 324 patients lined up. And
324 patients.
324 okay. were totally blind. And we operated side by side, myself and Dr. Ruit, and in just a couple of days, we restored sight to all of them.
Wow.
Which sounds very impressive until you get the breakdown that Dr. Ruit did 301 while I did 23. And what was more, I had to call Dr. Ruit over to help me about five times during my cases.
Wow.
And it was the most incredible thing. I finished and I said, wow, this is incredible. Dr. Ruit, I want to stay, and when I finish my fellowship, come and work with you.
And that was just the beginning right there.
Well, actually, it was a couple of things. One thing that I found out in the book, which I only found out later, was that, you know, in Nepal, people are very non-confrontational. It's a very gentle culture, and people don't say no. So if I say, you know, I'm going to come and I want to become a radio sidekick to you, Roger, I'll come every day.
Do it.
People don't say, no, you can't just do that. They say, well, maybe we'll see. And they don't really say no. So I came over and I started working with Dr. Ruit, and he already had his kind of system, and he was teaching cataract surgery, teaching ophthalmic assistants. And I think, you know, my energy and enthusiasm, he's a very introverted, quiet man. I kind of, you know, really wanted to sort of take this to another level. And he said, okay, Jeff, what we're going to do is we're going to send you to Bharatnagar. After I'd learned his cataract technique and his system, I want you to go teach in Bharatnagar. And the former head of the Nepal Ophthalmology Society, a very nice gentleman who didn't really have a lot of training and had never done microsurgery. And his name was a wonderful misnomer. It's Dr. I.C. Biswas, and very few of I.C.'s patients could.
Oh, wow.
And so I went thinking that he had given me this great task to try and transform eye care in Bharatnagar, which had this, you know, had no one doing modern surgery, population of a couple million. What I found out in the book was he sent me there during the monsoon on purpose. It was right during the monsoon in southern Nepal. And
He sent you to exile.
He sent me into exile, but he sent me to what he thought was an impossible task with, you know, every day was 110 degrees with 100% humidity, pouring rain, mosquitoes everywhere, no air conditioning, and really not the most pleasant living situation. And I found out from the book that he sent me there thinking he'd get rid of me, that he thought there's no way any Westerner would possibly want to go live in Bharatnagar, and I wouldn't last a week.
But you took to it.
And then I was there a week, and I started trying to bring up the hospital, and I was complaining about how poor the care was and putting a lot of demands on some of the workers there. And he called me on the phone and just chewed me out like, you can't even believe, you know, what are you doing? You're going to drive the only healthcare workers away. Are you going to spend the rest of your life in Bharatnagar? You might as well just leave the country now. You're not. And he was like every day beating on me, and which I found out later was really because he thought he would get rid of me.
He would chase you off.
And then after about 3 or 4 months, he realized that we were starting to do good cataract surgery. I taught the doctors. We had the mid-level healthcare providers doing a lot of sort of elevating their skills. And he kind of took a little bit of notice. And then he was invited by the government of China to do the first ever cataract surgery in Tibet and to train the first Tibetan doctors to do cataract surgery. And he invited me along. And at that time, he sort of, I think, realized that he kind of needed a Western ally and that, you know, my enthusiasm, we might be able to do something together. And it was only when we went to Tibet together after a very successful cataract program up in Tibet that kind of a drunken evening, we sort of ended up hugging and saying, well, we're going to spend our lives and we'll do something for the cataract project.
The beginning of a beautiful friendship.
And it is. And so the book is a lot the story of our friendship and then how that's also led to changes in eye care development and cataract surgery.
And so that's something I want to ask you about. The work that you two have done has become a bit of a model. I know that the U.S. Army has consulted with you. USAID gave you, I think, a $2 million grant to train people, or gave the project a $2 million grant.
Actually, quite a bit more than that. We've had $10 million in USAID grants for our program in Nepal. We've had $2 million for our program in Ghana and about $1 million for our program in Ethiopia.
You know, the amount of money it costs for somebody to have cataract surgery here versus the amount of money it costs to have cataract surgery done in the developing world with your assistance is remarkably disparate. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, again, Dr. Ruid is really the genius behind everything that we've done. I'm kind of the fat boy who plays because I bring the ball.
Right.
And I've been sort of hanging on his coattails. But he had, and also we have some other great, of the worldwide, there are about three or four great eye care development programs. And, you know, we're, I'm proud to say, one of them, but there's also the Aravind Eye Hospital System in India, the L.V. Prasad Eye Hospital System in India. And we've all kind of piggybacked and gone back and forth and shared and expanded our techniques. But one of the things that they've done, or we've done, is really created a system with really efficient mid-level health workers and everyone working up to their best level. And we have a one-year program after eighth grade to train ophthalmic assistants, a three-year program after high school to train ophthalmic technicians, a one-year program after nursing school to train ophthalmic nurses. Then we started training our best young people who were interested in ophthalmology in cataract surgery. And once we had some good young cataract surgeons, we sent them abroad to either Australia or here in the States for subspecialty training. And once we completed that, we then began a full residency program, and we now have our full subspecialty fellowships in Nepal. So one part is the education. The second is a lack of redundancy in the system. You know, there's so much extraneous things that happen in our medical system and our whole process, and just really paring everything down, getting all the waste out of the system, and having no sacrifice on quality and absolute top patient care. But a lot of the extraneous extra costs are sort of filtered away and really maximizing the use of everybody's time.
And these are people who, I mean, as far as the specialists, the sort of mid-level medical professionals, these are guys who are specializing specifically in cataract surgery for the most part.
No, not in cataract surgery, in ophthalmology. The only people who are doing the surgery are physicians or ophthalmologists who've now had full training.
Got it.
So no one is doing surgery, but the population of Nepal is very spread out. It's a lot in the hills. Transportation is often difficult. And we're taking smart young kids who've graduated from 12th grade in remote areas, bringing them to Kathmandu for training. And they come back as a mid-level healthcare provider. Kind of, they refract, they give glasses, they prevent infections, they give primary eye care, and they screen. And either they then send them to, we have cataract centers now. Nepali doctors are now doing about 250,000 cataract surgeries each year.
Wow.
So it's actually Nepal and another country which we took over the eye care system of in 1999, which is Bhutan, are the only two major countries in the developing world that are actually reducing dramatically their blindness rate.
That's remarkable.
And we're now starting also to use our program as a main training base. And actually, we've been training doctors from North Korea, from Myanmar, Indonesia, remote places in Asia. But also, we're using our hospital in Nepal as a main training center for African doctors.
So in some ways, it's a model that's expanding. I mean, is that? Okay, yeah. And let me just ask one quick question, which is, Trying to think of what else I can get into. We're towards the end of my usable time here. I'm losing my thread.
So a little bit about David Rellin. Yes, he passed away. And
sure, yeah, and, the author. Yeah. I would love to hear about him. I mean, I know that. I'm assuming he suffered from depression. But tell me about him. Yeah, sorry.
Well, David Rellin was really a wonderful guy. He was a beautiful writer who wrote Three Cups of Tea. And he really felt that he could use his journalism as a way of promoting good and change in the world. And he was proud of what he had done to promote education in East Asia and Central Asia. And when the controversy erupted over Three Cups of Tea,
right.
He felt really quite terrible. And that book was a book that was told to him by Greg Mortensen.
Right.
And so for this book, he really traveled with us. And he spent 2 years. He traveled with me to Africa several times, to Asia numerous times. And he really wrote from what he saw and really wrote from his heart. And on his first experience, he actually was originally going to be writing a book about one of our other local Nepali Utah people, Apa Sherpa, who's climbed Mount Everest 20 times.
Oh, wow.
And he went on a trek in Nepal with Apa Sherpa, and I convinced him to go and see Dr. Ruit. And he saw the same thing that I had seen that blew my mind, blew his mind, watching the miracle of cataract surgery. And he was so overwhelmed. There was one young woman who had gone blind who couldn't feed her family and had to sell her sewing machine, and she'd been a seamstress. Once she got her sight back, David right away took his own money and bought her a new sewing machine. And during the course of his 2 years of traveling with me, he started paying the school fees of no less than 14 kids who either had had their sight restored or their parents had had their sight restored and they could go back to school.
Wow.
And he became really involved with the project. And the book's really David Rellin's kind of firsthand view. I think it makes me out to be a little bit maybe more loony than I actually am, or maybe it's the way I am, and makes Dr. Ruit out to be maybe a little more intimidating than he really is. But it's a really, I think, a great story of friendship, but also of the whole way the developments come full circle.
Wonderful. Dr. Tabin, I because of the time, I guess I'm going to say thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you in the studio.
Okay, can I say one more
sure,
one more little thing that we can maybe edit in? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe I'll cut it in. You know, I'll send you guys the final version. But I want to ask actually one thing before you go there, which is what is the cause of cataracts? Like what causes cataracts?
Cataracts are a normal aging change and a breakdown of the crystalline structure and the proteins of the lens of the eye. If we all live long enough, we'll have decreased vision from cataracts. But that process is markedly increased by intense UV light. So equatorial regions, and particularly high-altitude regions, people tend to go blind at a faster rate. A second factor is a lack of antioxidants in the diet. We have the intense UV light causes oxidative damage to the lens proteins, and if you don't have antioxidants in your diet, again, it progresses faster. So people in Nepal who only eat rice, only eat sampa, don't have green leafy vegetables, go blind faster. A third factor is chronic diarrhea, and the intense fluid shifts of chronic dysentery in places where there's bad water supply also break down some of the proteins in the lens with these changes in hydration and lead to very early. We have a lot of people who go blind in their 30s, 40s, and many, many by their 50s.
And so I cut you off, Dr. Tabin. You were going to say something else as well.
I just wanted to say that, you know, currently I work, you know, at the University of Utah's Moran Eye Center, which has fantastic care for our local region. We're also doing outreach, but we're also using the Moran Eye Center now as a partner institution for a lot of our training in Africa. And we've developed a very unique fellowship program where the leading doctors who will be the future teachers of ophthalmologists in sub-Saharan Africa are coming to get their surgical training in Nepal, a very high volume, but also we're combining it with the top-level academics at the Moran Eye Center.
And so this is what's next for the work that you're doing is expansion into sub-Saharan Africa with assistance from Moran Eye Center.
And, you know, full full partnership with the Himalayan Cataract Project.
And so what if people want to get involved in either that project or the work you're doing to bring sight to people?
Well, they can look at our website. It's www.cureblindness.org. And there's all kinds of things people can do, either as volunteers. They can also consult the Moran Eye Center website for things that they can do to help out around here. If they want to come abroad, of course, we're always, as we've started expanding more into Africa, we're having more financial needs. And the system in Asia has really been wonderful with cost recovery. So once we've trained doctors and equipped them, the pay system that Dr. Ruit developed and the Aravind Eye Hospital system developed allows things to thrive without needing external support. So it's completely self-sustaining.
And a duplicable model.
And we're trying to bring the same system to Africa, but we're still at an impasse where we need to create the quality level and the situation for the local doctors to stay. So people can look at our website. It's www.cureblindness.org.
I will have them do that. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Roger.
That's Dr. Jeff Tabin. Tabin is one of the subjects of the new book Second Sons by author David Oliver Rellin, a co-author of the best-selling Three Cups of Tea. You can find a full version of our discussion at our website, kcpw.org. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Mark Alvarez, immigration expert at Telemundo Utah, brings us up to speed on the state of the immigration reform legislation headed to the House of Representatives. We'll hear about the position of Utah's representatives and about the impact the broken immigration system has had on families in Utah. That interview and more coming up tomorrow on The Rundown here on KCPW. The Rundown was produced today by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us today for The Rundown from KCPW. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next. Stay with us.